Today, what Christian leaders ought to do with their power.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
You know, today's topic is so hot, so fresh on my mind that we have to address it. And it deals with some things that transpired recently. In fact, yesterday, as I'm recording this, a few days ago, as you're getting access to it on the podcast. But we absolutely have to address it. And it's not in the nature of those who are following Christ to withdraw from a controversy. It's not in our calling to simply engage in a battle either. We are to be peacemakers. That's why we're pursuing that, and that's what I've been talking about since the beginning of this podcast, and so that's the direction we'll go. But there are values underlying this issue that we simply have to address, and it has to do with things that you've been hearing for the last several years as the Me Too movement and the discussions surrounding sexual abuse survivors and their accusations, and then those who cover up those accusations and so on. And it especially has to do with how that has played out in the largest non-Catholic denomination in the United States, in the Southern Baptist Convention. And it's not just that. We're not just going to be talking about the Southern Baptist Convention. So it doesn't matter whether you're Southern Baptist or not, in my encouragement to you to hear this conversation, but to know there are some basic values in Christianity that ought to govern the way we handle things like this. And I've seen some people really modeling that extremely well and in a blessed way. And I've seen other people modeling exactly the opposite. And so that's what I want us to be able to address. And as you hear us refer to some articles or websites or other things like that on the show today included, you can go to barrycreamer.com and actually look at some more details about the podcast. That's where all of these are available. And of course, they're available, well, you know, you're listening to it. So it's available wherever you started listening to it. I guess I can stop there. So I have a couple of guests with me today that I want to introduce first, and then I'm going to mention something about a basic concept regarding the Me Too movement or victim advocacy regarding sexual abuse, especially the abuse of women. It's not just about women, but it is there is a lot of it that's about women who've been abused and young women who've been abused. But before I do that, I want to introduce a couple of guests. First, Rob Collingsworth, who is the Director of External Relations at Criswell College, where I'm president, love serving with Rob. I've been working with him for six years now.
Yeah, next week.
Six years, amazing. So anyway, really nice to have you on the show. And Rob is not only Director of External Relations, but one of the reasons he is that for us, and I tease Rob about this in some ways, I'm not teasing this time, so much, but he has a long and deep family history with the Southern Baptist Convention, and he himself is engaged with a lot of people in the convention. In fact, it's always weird, no matter where I go, Rob's like, oh, yeah, that's my uncle's best friend, and you know, and so on. So appreciate you being on the show with us.
Thanks for having me.
Have the conversation. Also, Jared Wellman. So Jared's the pastor at Tate Springs Baptist Church in Arlington. He is a member of the Executive Committee of the Southern Baptist Convention, which for those of you who know this topic fairly well, know how important that is right now. But also, he's a Criswell College alum and a really great friend in the ministry. So, by the way, serves on the Board of Trustees for Criswell College, too. And so, Jared Wellman, really nice to have you on the program as well.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
All right. So here's the thing. I have a basic way that I approach conversations about the Me Too movement. And I know this is not just Me Too movement. And certainly, Jared, I don't want it to stick there. But that's where this first came up. And so I want to mention this real quickly. And either of you two, if you have input to what I'm what I'm mentioning right now, feel free to throw it in.
Sure.
And this is not the background part. We'll talk about the background, the historical part, in just a second. But you know, in my assessment of what's going on, you know, when a woman raises her voice and says, "I have been the victim of sexual abuse. Someone used their power to manipulate me or use me in a way that that wouldn't have been consensual, wasn't consensual, or was just harmful to me in some way." That women's voices, in my accounting of our history and my best understanding of where we are in our culture right now, women's voices were excluded for so long, were discounted for so long, that we have to give added weight to every single story just to overcome a little of the historical cultural bias that we have. So this is starting out saying we have to reweight the conversation so that when a woman makes an accusation like this or raises her voice, gives an outcry, whatever term you want to use for that, that we give extra weight to that voice because of the weight that's been given against it for so long in our cultural history. So we start there, and you guys understand that. You understand where I'm coming from, right? Jared, and you've heard a ton of these stories for reasons we'll talk about in a minute, but does that part make sense to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I've thought the very same thing.
Yeah, and actually, you've done that, I know, and we'll give some details to how you've done that. But the historical bias, by the way, shows up partially, and this is the saddest part of it, in victim blaming. Where we have, and for a lot of people, they don't even recognize that's what we've done. But that when a woman was abused, when a woman was approached, when she was traumatized in any way, that we would even ask the question, well, what was she wearing? That we would even ask the question, well, where was she? Well, why was she hanging out with that guy? Well, why did she go home with him? Well, that we would even ask that is part of the problem with where we have been as a society in hearing or not hearing the outcry of a woman who might be a victim of something like this. So anyway, that's the first step, is giving extra weight to those voices right now. Secondly, though, and this is in contrast to that first statement, doesn't undermine it, but it is in contrast to it. Each story, we acknowledge, has its own set of real facts for adjudication. So when we actually make a decision about whether a man committed an abuse, about whether a woman committed an abuse, about whether an institution protected someone, we actually have to look at the facts that are going on about that particular case. Because we're not going to make people blanket guilty because there is a blanket systemic historical or cultural problem that's been going on. And you guys are with me on this also?
100%.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Jared, you're good on that?
Mm.
Yeah. All right, good deal. So now, last step. Our job becomes, and this is what I mean for us as believers, but as anybody who's advocating on behalf of someone who might not be heard otherwise, and you can imagine, especially with sexual abuse victims, the idea that that victim would then have to rise up and be the one to stand in advocacy of their own case is absurd. That is not what you do when a person has been traumatized by someone who used their power to traumatize them. You don't say, well, just get up on your own hind legs and solve the problem. You advocate on their behalf. And for believers, certainly we should be doing that. So our job then becomes making sure that since that voice is now being heard and yet the facts have to be adjudicated, our job is to make sure that the adjudication happens and that it's fair. That's what we're required to do, which means we have to stand up and help the victim, but not pretend like there aren't real facts that have to be dealt with. That's the basic assessment that I'm bringing to things in the broad scope of the Me Too movement and the outcries that we've heard from people who've been abused over the last, and they've been abused for a long time. So, Jared,
I would add to that, you know, just as a biblical thrust behind this, just the parable of the Good Samaritan, you know, and we always look at the parable, and we think about the broken man. And of course, as the parable is being told, we think of the Levite and the priest who walk beside him and the Good Samaritan. And it's a rich parable. There's so many things to pull out of it. And the obvious principle there is to stop and help the person, you know? But I think one thing that we also need to make sure of is that we're not the one who's actually doing the breaking, that we're not the one who is leaving the person on the side of the road. And I think that the way that we handle this really important subject, without knowing it, we can actually be someone who's actually, who's not just walking by and maybe ignoring, but maybe kicking. And this, I'm intentionally saying this in a strong way, but if we're not careful, we can mishandle this in such a way where we're not just ignoring them, but we're actually kicking them as we are ignoring them.
Yeah. Wow.
Jared, I saw you tweet that, and I saw a response to your tweet. I don't know if you saw it, but someone says, generally, I try to follow the principle of not inserting myself into the biblical text. But when I do, I try to insert myself in the worst possible light or as the worst possible character. And I think the temptation is for us to see ourselves in that story as the Samaritan passing on the side of the road doing the helping, or we're David in the David and Goliath story. And I had never in my life until I saw your tweet thought, are we the ones doing the robbing and the kicking and the beating and leaving people on the side of the road? Is that us collectively or me individually? And that thought, I think, bears thinking about, yeah, and considering.
Yeah, and this I love the parable, the comparison there, the analogy, Jared, and I appreciate you bringing it up, to put more flesh on those bones, and what it means for that person to have been left damaged on the side of the road. We have to look back. This is going to be a challenge in some ways. So we have to, you know, we have to take a couple of steps back. So I love declaring that Jesus is Lord. I love the fact that the resurrection is real and that it makes a difference in my life and the lives of people that I love. I am traumatized by, I am hurt, I'll say, by how badly Christianity, and I mean that as the institutions and the practices around Christianity, have responded to this victim on the road. And so I'm looking back historically, Jared and Rob, I want to, you know, put a little flesh on the bones like I was just talking about and say, you know, if we went back a few years and we remember the Me Too movement and Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby and all the things that were going on with accusations coming out and now women's voices being heard and not just suppressed because their careers depended on them being silent and so on, that some courageous people stepped up and did that. That happened before, that happened in the culture, in the papers, in the press, in Hollywood, before it came to the church. As I remember it, that's what I recall. Is that as
from a standpoint of timeline, I mean, I think you're right.
That's tragic. I don't even know, I don't know how to be ashamed enough to deal with it and to be honest about it, that it then found its way into the church. And it didn't find its way into the church by us rising up and saying, hey, we look at this Me Too movement. We need to do something about this. Wasn't there a Houston Chronicle article or something like that a few years
yes.
ago?
Yes. And go ahead, Jared.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with all this. I've shared the same thing with our church before. You know, I've shared that it's a tragedy that a secular culture got something right that the church is now. When I say got it right, what I mean is giving what we would call abuse survivors the right to speak and to share their story and to listen and to help. All these things were happening in the culture, and they were being exposed in the culture. And the church now is responding to what's happening in the culture. It reminds me a little bit about what's often called Schaefer's staircase, where in one of his books, he talks about how sometimes the church swims downstream of culture. So, you know, something happens in philosophy and then art and music and then culture and then ultimately ends up in the church. And
and
really, I mean, that is upside down for what the Bible says.
And historically.
We're supposed to be, influencing culture. And we ought to be the leaders of these kinds of things. And so it's not a difficult thing to say that abuse is wrong. And it's not a difficult thing to say these things. And yet we're still struggling to get it right. Mm-hmm. And the church is way behind. The convention right now is way behind on this issue. And it is an absolute tragedy.
Well, in fact, go ahead, Rob.
No, I was just going to say, Jared, to go along with your point and to circle back to what you were saying a second ago, Barry, I obviously have been beating this drum for a long time, and it's my, you know, my undergrad was in journalism. My background is journalism. I have a deep desire. I didn't just do journalism because it was a thing. I did it because I had this desire to see truth come to light, you know, and the things in the shadows come out and be put into the light. The fact that the Me Too movement happened was a direct result of Ronan Farrow and reporters doing their job, the Fourth Estate doing their job to ask tough questions. And if you even pay attention to that, it's not like it was an easy downhill battle for them. I mean, the story, right, the catch and kill, the story of them trying to get the original Harvey Weinstein Me Too story, that was nearly impossible to get published by the secular media because of Weinstein's influence.
Which it's almost unthinkable. It's almost beyond conception that it would be the case that the powers that be would work so hard to protect a person they knew was predatory. They knew so well was predatory. It was a joke in the Academy Awards when people would talk about it. But
my point simply is to say that in the culture, the way it started was the press. And the way it started in our denomination, just at least with the SBC, and we can go back to the Catholic Church, talking about the Boston Globe and Spotlight, right, but these things have started from journalists, from the press saying, we're going to take things in the shadows and drag them into the light.
And then we are
crippled by, and I'm going to speak just for the SBC, as a denomination, and I highly respect the guy who is in charge of communications over Baptist Press right now. Jonathan Howe is a champion. But we are simply crippled by the structure of it, that Baptist Press is housed underneath the executive committee.
That they don't get to do independent journalism.
It's currently under investigation right now. And the thing that led to the instigator, the catalyst of this investigation, was itself bad, false reporting about an abuse victim that was refused to be corrected because it was led not by journalists.
And hang right there, because I want to come to that detail. That's a really important detail that a lot of people don't understand. They don't know that that happened. And a lot of people don't know this story at all. So I want to back up one step again and mention that, you know, not only does it come to the church late from the culture, Jared, but then when it comes to light in the Southern Baptist Convention, that this Houston Chronicle article that we need some accountability in our churches and some way of identifying.
A secular non-Christian paper journalist is the one who broke this story that brought it to light in our convention in 2019. This is why we're here.
And so you, as a member of the executive committee, and we're not going to go into all the polity of what the executive committee does, but y'all work when the convention's not in session, and you sort of represent the leadership of the Southern Baptist Convention during the interim periods, you know, each year. Mm-hmm. You're the people that lead. So you all have this information. You know that there's a problem. Something needs to be done about it. You have the opportunity to do something about it. And I don't know exactly how this happens, Jared, but what I observed from the outside is the executive committee just chose not to do the right thing, not to hear these stories, not to give them the proper accounting. And you did something about that. So can you fill in those details so that I don't?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
So it goes back. My involvement. I've been an executive committee member for about 6 years. I think you can get up to 2 4-year terms. So you go. When you become the messenger's electees, you become one for 4 years, and then you can be reelected for a second 4-year term, so up to 8 years. I'm on my second term. I think I'm in the middle of it. I thought this was my last year. I thought I was getting out, but they pulled me back in.
No.
I think I have a year or two left. And so my first term was pretty uneventful until the previous president was fired for an inappropriate relationship. And that is when a vacuum began. And during that time, Dr. J.D. Greer was the president of the convention. And Rob Downen at the Houston Chronicle had published an article, I think at the end of 2018 or beginning of 2019, that basically brought the Me Too movement to the convention. It was 700 plus survivors. And so really, we've been in the thick of it since then. And so in response to that, we have at the EC, we have three meetings a year, one in February, one in September, and one the day before the convention in June, wherever the convention's held. February and September are always in Nashville at the EC offices there. So we're there in February, and JD gives his speech. The president always gives a speech on the Monday night of the meetings. And he, in it, he addresses the issues, and he lists 10 churches. I think nine of them were Southern Baptist churches that he asked the EC, the bylaw work group, to look into to see whether or not they were violating the bylaws about what it means to be a Southern Baptist church. Now, at this time, there was no mechanism in place for the convention to deal with this issue. Since then, we've created a credentials committee. But at that time, it really came down to just a handful of people on what was called the bylaw work group. And so what happened that weekend, the very same week, that weekend, the bylaw work group essentially cleared every church. They just said, no, there's no problems here. Well, it turned out at least one of the churches had a known confessed abuser on their staff, and they were cleared by this bylaw work group. And so when all that's happened, I'm watching this as an EC member, and I'm, you know, I play my part, but, you know, it bothered me deeply to see how things were unfolding and to see how things were just not being taken seriously, that we could just hear this report, read this article, and just say, oh, there's no problem. So at that point, I offered my email to survivors on Twitter, and I said, listen, I'm an EC member, because I saw how the EC was as at large was not listening. And I said, you know, I'll do what I can. I didn't know what to do. But I said, I just want you to know there's at least someone on the EC who's willing to hear. And so that's kind of how I got involved in that. And so I received countless emails, got to know, you know, many of the survivors' stories, and it really helped me understand their perspective of the situation. And so since then, we've kind of been in this battle for really what I would say is just, you know, doing right by them. And I call it the new castle in the wall moment in the convention. A good Southern Baptist will understand Gregory's art illustration about that. And essentially, I feel like the EC is making decisions where we're protecting the castle at the expense of the citizens, especially the survivors. And so that happened in 2019. And really since then, we've created a credentials committee. And now here we are all the way fast forward to this past June, where the messengers gave a historic motion and in historical fashion to bring it back up. And 15,000 plus messengers voted overwhelmingly for there to be an investigation into the EC. Now, a lot of people will ask, why is the EC being investigated? And I had that same question because the article that Rob had referenced earlier from Baptist Press really is the most public situation that I cite when people ask, why is the EC being investigated? What's the EC's involvement? Well, essentially, at some point, I cited three things publicly in last week's meetings in Nashville, and I'll share them here, which is, number one, you had a president of the executive committee who was fired for an inappropriate relationship. Then number two, the person who took his position when he was fired was the vice president during JD's speech during this time, and he since has been legally banned from being able to serve in any, from what I understand, any nonprofit, but certainly any Southern Baptist committees or organizations.
Any nonprofit banned. In the state of Texas. Al Gubodo cannot serve on any nonprofit board in the state.
You had a president and a vice president that were leading the EC. And so that's the issue there. Now, when he left, when the new leadership came, there was, and as an EC member, I wasn't made aware of this until it became public. And now it's public, so we can talk about it. But Baptist Press had originally published an article about Jennifer Lyell about a situation she was involved with a professor from Southern. And when they reported it essentially as an affair. And she served at Lifeway, and it ruined her life because it mischaracterized her through this article. And I won't go into the details of what people called her when they saw her at the convention and such, but it devastated her life. And so there were all these things happening behind the scenes with EC leadership, which included the chairman at the time and whoever the leadership was at that time. And so Baptist Press had, and you can go and look at this, they re-released an article to correct it, which shows that there was a misrepresentation. Now, none of that.
It wasn't an affair. It was abuse.
Exactly.
That was the issue.
Exactly. And so they clarified that, but after the damage had been done.
And just to clarify again, just to emphasize, and this is the point that Rob was making a moment ago, that Baptist Press is accountable to the EC. And so the EC leadership had a sway had an opportunity to sway.
So Jennifer, the victim in this case had spent months with the backing of multiple entity heads and pastors of churches with this undisputed claim telling them, trying to go to the EC under the leadership of Ronnie Floyd to say, here's what actually happened. Please issue a correction. Please change this, change the language. Please do the right thing, and I'll sign a non-disclosure agreement. I'll do whatever you want. Please just change this so I won't continue to get this harassment. I mean, she's had to, like, stop teaching Sunday school at her church because of the parents of these children who are going, why do we have an adulterer teaching Sunday school? Yeah. It's crazy. And if you look at the timeline again, why did they finally update that thing?
But this is before the fact that it happened is bad enough.
I mean
the fact that the Baptist Press then changed the story.
Oh, of course.
So that now we know the way it should have been reported was as abuse.
The fact that it happened is evidence that there are essentially shenanigans that need to be investigated, and that's why we're at this.
So I want to pause here for a second, though, and say, but that's one story which reflects a problem in how all of these stories are handled in church leadership at a congregational level, in state conventions, in the national convention, and if this particular story involves leadership of the executive committee itself and leadership of the convention itself, then, you know, we're talking about something that has fingers that go out throughout this millions of members denomination. And so I want to come back to this point of what happened with the convention this summer, Jared. You were mentioning the investigation that's ongoing now with the executive committee. The Southern Baptist Convention messengers, so they all meet in Nashville, 15,000 messengers or so, and they vote for a third-party investigation of the entities of the EC, of the executive committee, regarding sexual abuse accusations. Is that a fair assessment of what happened at the convention?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And Jared, you understand that too. Okay, so then there are a couple of additions to that investigation, like a requirement that the executive committee not, because the executive committee manages the will of the messengers, you know, between convention meetings. And yet the messengers are saying, we want the executive committee investigated. So there's a little conflict there. Hey, you guys hire a company to investigate yourselves. And then you guys report back to us whatever they found out.
And I can speak a little bit more about how that came about as
go.
Well, because there's more that's been lost in the details.
Yes.
So, leading up to June, leading up to the convention, there was a lot of buzz about the need for an investigation. And so it was evident that there was going to be something that happened at the convention. Well, I was talking with Roland, the current chairman, about this, and we were conversing about the need for this, and there was resistance towards it, obviously. There still is. So that's not the secret. And so essentially what happened was the EC then, the staff, and this is a really important thing to be for clarification. Right now what we have is the messengers who have spoken, and then you have the executive committee who, and every entity is supposed to listen to the messengers. That's the way it works, because the messengers represent the churches, and that's the unique characteristic of the convention. But right now you have a division between in the EC itself, between the staff and a large number, about 50% of the EC at least, and then the messengers. So you essentially have a division in the EC, and then you have the messengers. And so leading up to the convention, I'll summarize this so I won't belabor the point, but the staff decided that they were going to investigate themselves. And so, but the problem was you can't investigate yourself. So they controlled their report. It was, hey, we've hired this company by Guidepost, but it was a very limited scope. And so in June, I brought a motion, which is essentially the same motion that Gaines and Parrott brought to the messengers. And it was essentially, let's expand this so that privilege is waived, and basically we can have a transparent investigation that truly gets to the core of the issues here.
And I just want to clarify, when you say privilege, we mean attorney-client privilege, because...
Exactly. And really what that means is anything that's been shared with a lawyer present becomes privileged, and you have to get the right. You have to get the right to get access to that information. So, I offered a motion to do that. I did it. And here's a couple of ingredients to the puzzle. I did this before the agenda was approved, and I did that. It was chaotic, but I did it intentionally for one reason. I had coffee with Roland that morning.
Roland
is the chairman of the EC.
Okay.
And I asked him, I said, I want to bring this motion. What can I bring it? He said, let's do it right here. So we had a plan. But while we were having coffee, he said that he received a text from a staff member who said, we need to go into executive session. And so executive session has become a weapon of the executive committee, not unlike a filibuster, which is to basically anything that happens in executive session cannot be spoken of. And so if I made this motion executive session and it failed, then no one would ever know that it happened. So because of that, I found a gray area, and I went before the agenda, and I just stood up and made the motion. Well, chaos ensued. And essentially what happened is the meeting was hijacked. They voted to approve the agenda, and then they said, now we can see if we want to vote to change the agenda to include this. And so there was all this discussion, and the EC ultimately voted not to even amend the agenda, to even discuss the investigation that the staff itself hired, apart from the EC's, the trustees even having a say in it.
Right.
And then later on in the meeting, they spent an hour belaboring the point. This goes back to the Luke 10 thing and the New Testament in general. They spent an hour talking about seats of power. So they wouldn't even talk about how we can serve the abused, but they spent an hour talking about who should be in charge, to the point where one EC member demanded that the EC go to the mics at the convention and keep who was the vice chairman on. And so that's what we're dealing with right now.
I just have to interrupt enough to say this is the antithesis of what Christianity is supposed to be about.
Absolutely.
We're spending our time defending positions of power so that we can ignore voices that have been ignored for too long.
Yeah.
It's almost beyond conception that it could be true, and yet I know this is exactly how it happened. It's just shocking. Go ahead. I interrupted you, but so this is all taking place at the meeting in June. When
this
the executive committee,
yeah,
yeah, okay,
and so it's been, so this battle has been the staff. Really, what's happening right now is the staff is fighting against the will of the messengers. It comes down to the motion that was that required the waiving of attorney-client privilege. So, and also there to be a third party that is outside the EC who can be neutral and not hired by the EC. So instead what happened after June is the EC went, who already has two lawyers, and they hired two more lawyers to defend and try to keep this thing from happening. So we're at an impasse right now since June, ultimately because the staff of the EC is refusing, and the lawyers that they've hired are refusing to honor the will of the messengers, and that's where we are at this moment.
And so a couple of other things have happened that make this, well, that happened at the convention as an expression of what the messengers wanted to do. So what's the, how does the task force on sexual abuse, that this task force was formed, that's also involved in this somehow or another. What's their role right now? Jared, do you have an impression of that?
So their role is supposed to be the outside organization who receives the report. And so the messengers, what they creatively did in order to investigate the EC was because the EC was showing that they, you know, hey, we're going to do an investigation, but we're going to hire the company. We're going to receive the report. Then we're going to edit it and send it out. That's not a true investigation.
And it should be noted as an addendum quickly that their investigation was announced after two pastors had very publicly announced that a motion was going to be made at the convention.
Exactly.
Where they were going to be. They put the text of the motion on Twitter, and it had a lot of traction. And so people knew. No one. It was not a question of if an investigation was going to happen before the convention. It was a matter of who was going to direct it. And so it's hard to interpret the executive committee's decision to instigate an investigation about a week before the annual meeting as anything other than scrambling.
Yeah.
Now I don't know intentions, but I mean it doesn't look great.
Jared, go ahead.
I can confirm that because it wasn't so. Roland, as the chairman, was not aware that they were doing this, and he came out in Religion News Service and said, "I agree with expanding or with a third party investigation. You can look at this; it's all public." And so he wasn't aware of it, and so it did at least look. Who knows? But it did at least look like it was. Hey, let's go do this to get in front of it. And the messengers read the writing on the wall, you know, and so, for clarity, when you say he
was unaware of it, Roland was unaware, and Roland's the chair of the trustees of the executive committee.
Yeah.
He was unaware that the staff was instigating.
Which is the fundamental problem.
Am I correct there, Jared?
You're right in that. And that's the fundamental problem for anyone who's confused is that it should be the messengers and then the trustees and then the staff. And right now what's happening is the staff are directing the trustees and the trustees are, you know, supposed to be directing the messengers. And this is the larger narrative of the SBC in general. When the EC brought all these things to the table, a new business and financial plan, a vision 2025, everything that the EC brought to the messengers was either declined. So the Lifeway change, the business and financial report, and also Vision 2025 was amended. So there was nothing that the EC essentially brought that the messengers accepted. And everything they were doing was to try to design the EC to become more of a super committee that had kind of a control over the EC. And so it's becoming kind of an upside down polity again.
Okay, so
it goes against fundamentally what it means to be a Southern Baptist.
Yeah, so let's back up just a little bit from the details of what's happening with. Well, actually, I want to lean into one detail that we haven't brought up yet, but do it for the purpose of saying how should we respond to things like this? What are we supposed to do? So, Jared, we haven't talked about this detail yet, but you've been in these meetings. I mean, you are in the executive committee, so you're present. You know why, out of how many EC members are there, Jared? How many executives?
There's a little over 80.
Okay, so right around 80.
It fluctuates because sometimes people have to step off, but yeah, sure. Like 82, 84.
Okay, so out of all of those representatives, messengers who are serving on the executive committee, you know, it's hard to fathom that people would vote not to have an honest and open investigation. And they're not saying, let's have a dishonest investigation, but there's a conflict of interest that amounts to the same thing when you say, let's have an investigation, but we can't give them details about things we said in secret because that might put us at jeopardy. In the way that's been conveyed to you, as I understand it, has it been implied that their, and I'm going to use the word, fiduciary obligation as trustees is why they should not give up the attorney-client privilege, which is what creates the conflict. Is it the fiduciary obligation that you're hearing?
Yeah, there's a lot of debate, and it's essentially, according to yesterday's vote, it's essentially right down the middle. It's a different interpretation about, I mean, we had one EC member who said 15,000 messengers, and this was public, he said 15,000 messengers cannot tell us what to do. And so that's a different interpretation than I personally have as an EC member. I mean, for me, it's a really simple thing. It's the messengers told us clearly what to do, so we should do it. And so the core thing that is hanging us up is the waiving of attorney-client privilege. And so you have some nuanced understandings. And to be sure, there are people on all parts of the spectrum of their understanding of this. People,
sure,
you know, who are like myself, who are like, hey, the messenger spoke. We just need to do this and then figure out, you know, let the chips fall and figure it out from there. And then some people who are on the other side of the spectrum, you know, who have comments like that. And then people on the spectrum, another EC member said, he said, assuming there are survivors. And so he's making the claim that there might not even be survivors, which to me, I find baffling based on the last 2 years of life as a Southern Baptist, and not to mention just as an American on what we're seeing.
And that comes directly to all the email you personally received, which others didn't want to hear about, didn't want to receive. You personally received from all of these victims who are talking about their stories, which is why I went back at the very beginning of the show to say, because of the history of suppressing these stories, we have to make sure they get heard. Then you do an adjudication on the facts and find out what actually happened and who should be censured or something else. But you first have to get to that point. And Jared, I have to say, I mean, doesn't it seem obvious? Am I overlooking something here? Because, you know, when you become a trustee, you take on you hold the entity in trust. It's your responsibility. But it's not just holding the assets, the finances in trust. It's the mission of the entity, the purpose of that entity that you hold in trust. And it doesn't make sense to me that people are saying we can't give up attorney-client privilege because it would risk all of the financial assets of the Southern Baptist Convention, apparently, if people knew what was said under attorney-client privilege, which is the point of doing the investigation, because the mission of our organization should be taking up the cause of the defenseless.
That's exactly how I understand it as well. And I think that I think that survivors have become kind of a political football in all of this. And
that's shameless.
What grieves me deeply is in Nashville, we show up, you know, the 80 plus members, and we debate this for 2 days, and people are making comments like what I just shared about assuming there are survivors, when literally there is a row of survivors right behind me.
And in the room? In the room.
That paid their way to go.
Whoever said that should be ashamed.
And I can hear them weeping. I can hear them crying as we're debating. And I can only imagine if I were the one who had been abused, and I felt like, you know, the future of justice is in the hands of these people who, you know, who are more worried about, you know, the insurance or the money or the protection of this or that, rather than, you know, there's been a lot of talk lately about the sufficiency of scripture. But yet the fact is we've really turned more to the sufficiency of lawyers and the sufficiency as a Southern Baptist, we come together for cooperative program money to do good work. But the goal is not just the money. The money is supplementary to the purpose. And so as a trustee, my goal is the purpose of our gathering, and everything else is supplementary to that. And the purpose is people. And so it's really simple for me. I mean, my mind's been made up since June. And so the motion, I've made it twice now. It fell 55-20 last week. It fell 39-34 in the recent vote. And I'm motivated to keep going because I think it's the right thing to do.
Good for you. I appreciate that. We've only got a couple of more minutes or a few more minutes. I want to give each of you a chance to just say, you know, what would you encourage believers to keep in mind, including Southern Baptists, but outside of that circle as well, to keep in mind? And I, on any side, I mean, you're right in the middle of all of this, and so I think it could be helpful. And I'll start with you, Rob, and then Jared, if you have something you want to add.
Sure. So, I mean, by the time we air this, the 7 days that were extended yesterday are going to be up. So, I mean, by the time we're airing this...
It'll be a few days.
But, I mean, the time's going to be up for this decision to have been made. I think the larger point, from my perspective, as someone who is convictionally Southern Baptist by choice and cares deeply about these things and wants to leave the convention better than I found it. I think ultimately we have to acknowledge that the gospel, the kingdom, are going to go forward by whatever means the Lord intends. Whether or not we as Southern Baptists get this right, and whether or not we as Southern Baptists continue to exist.
Or get to ride with the Lord on what he's doing.
Yeah, so I think it's tempting for me to for reasons of nostalgia and care and concern, be deeply concerned about these things while I'm a part of it for the sake of trying to make things better and for the sake of our cooperative work, which is the gospel, but not just let's go tell people about Jesus in other countries. Let's extend the care and compassion of Jesus to people who not just have been abused, but have been abused at the hands of pastors who claim our convention and the authority of our churches. That is devastating. And if we cannot see that the mission of Jesus is more than just going to other countries, and thank God for the IMB, but yes, it's that, but it's also saying, how can we wash the feet of survivors who not only have experienced horrific abuse, but have been re-traumatized and re-victimized by our collective failure to get it right?
Jared, do you have any other contributions? Thanks, Rob. Perfect.
Those are good words, Rob. I've essentially shared my heart. I would just say, I think we want to be on the right side of Southern Baptist history, but we also want Southern Baptist history to be on the right side. And there is a right side, and that's the truth. And right now, so long as we continue to evade that, it's just going to keep us under suspicion and we're just dragging our feet. But I agree, inevitably, God doesn't need the Southern Baptist Convention to accomplish his will. But how sad would it be if we weren't part of his will in history?
Yeah, amen to that. I will just throw on this that, I mean, people get nervous when I say words like this, but I mean, just read the Gospels. It's so obvious. Even Peter with his sword, Jesus is commanding him to understand that we're supposed to use our power for the weak. That's why he gives us power, so that we can serve others. It's what he did with his power when he was here. And the idea, you know, the greatest among you will be your servant, is not just, hey, I have all this power, I'm going to be servant-like. It means I am going to serve those who are not in power. This is the whole point of the one who humbles himself is exalted, and so on. This is our calling. And so I would point out, Jared, and I know y'all will agree with this, but I mean, the continuity of Christianity is not in its institutions anyway. That's just not how it's described in the New Testament. It's not what happens with the churches. It's not the church at Philippi or Ephesus that's, you know, a mega church today. It would be, and if it were, if the continuity of Christianity were in its institutions, then that would be a recipe for using power, the power we have, to defend those powerful institutions. But the continuity that we have in our Christianity is in our faith, in our doctrine, in the power of the resurrection. And the continuity of that faith is passed from one person to the next, from one community to the next, who actually reflect obedience to Christ and the things that we're called to do. And by the way, inherently that means that faith is communicated from one person to the next when one person uses their power, the power we have in Christ because of the resurrection, to lift up another person who had none. That's the nature of Christianity. And this is how I'll close. And Jared and Rob, unless y'all have something else to say, we'll finish here. To say this is the value we're supposed to bring to it. And Jared, thanks so much for taking time to do this, brother. I respect you greatly from the first moment I saw you write that tweet, and say, if you're a victim, email me. I will read your email. And as I understand it, and you can tell me if this is false, if this didn't turn out, but as I understand it, you read every one of those. You read every one of those stories.
Yeah, I read and responded to every call of them.
And I was so appreciative of that. It blessed me and encouraged me, and I'm not even the victim lying on the side of the road. So I appreciate you stopping to help the person who had been victimized. And Rob, I appreciate you taking time to step in here. And I know your passion for seeing this handled in the right way. And so to every person, you know, who is listening, I'm going to say this on the negative side, but to get to the positive, the last three words, the last Christian thing imaginable is that believers would use a power they have been given to protect that power instead of, and this is what we're called to do, instead of advocate for the vulnerable. That's what we're called to do. Thank you, brothers. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.